always known that she would be blamed? Would it be easier to suffer in silence to protect the children and to protect his career? In her most private moments, she had grieved over these conflicts. And now they were moot. She was single, without the stigma of a divorce. Her children were scarred, but the country was emerging from a war in which 500,000 American men were killed. Families everywhere were scarred, wounded, trying to cope and picking up the pieces. It appeared as though Dexter finally messed with the wrong woman, though Jackie had not suspected Liza Banning. She was certainly pretty enough and vulnerable. Jackie had been watching and had seen nothing out of line. But with a husband prone to cheat, every pretty woman was a potential target. Jackie wiped a tear as she ached for her husband. She would always love him, and her deep love made the suspicions even more painful. She hated it, and hated him for it, and at times she hated herself for not being strong enough to walk out. But those days were gone, weren't they? Never again would she watch Dexter drive away to visit the sick and wonder where he was really going. Never again would she be suspicious as he counseled behind a locked office door. Never again would she notice the round backside of a young lady in church and wonder if Dexter was admiring it too. The tears turned to sobs, and she couldn't stop. Was she crying out of grief, loss, anger, or relief? She didn't know and couldn't make sense of it. The album finished, and she walked to the kitchen for something else to drink. On the counter was a tall, layered cake with red icing, a Christmas concoction Errol McLeish had dropped off for the kids. She cut a slice, poured a glass of milk, and returned to the den. He was such a thoughtful man. Chapter 12. After a large Christmas brunch of bacon, omelets, and buttermilk biscuits, they said goodbye to Marietta in the pink cottage, and to all the birds, cats, and dogs, and they loaded themselves and their luggage into the car for a road trip. Joel was the chauffeur again, evidently a permanent position, because there was no offer of help from either of the two ladies in the rear seat. Both talked nonstop, cackling away and amusing their driver. WHBQ out of Memphis ran nothing but Christmas carols, but to hear them, Joel was forced to crank up the radio. The girls complained about the volume. He complained about their constant racket. Everyone laughed, and the road trip was off to a great start. Leaving Ford County behind was a relief. 3 hours later, they arrived at the imposing gate of the Mississippi State Hospital at Whitfield, and the mood in the car changed dramatically. Liza had been sent there 7 months earlier, and there had been almost no news about her treatment. They had written letters but received no replies. They knew that Pete had spoken to her doctors, but of course, he had passed along nothing from their conversations. Flory, Joel, and Stella were assuming Liza knew about the murder of Dexter Bell, but they wouldn't know for sure until they met with her doctors. It was entirely possible they were keeping such dreadful news away from her as protection. Again, Pete had told them nothing. A uniformed guard had some paperwork, then some directions, and the gate eventually swung open. Whitfield was the state's only psychiatric hospital, and it was an expansive collection of buildings spread over thousands of acres. It was called a campus, looked more like a grand old estate, and was surrounded by fields, woods, and forests. Over 3,000 patients lived there, along with 500 employees. It was segregated, with separate facilities for whites and blacks. Joel drove past a post office, a tuberculosis hospital, a bakery, a lake, a golf course, and the wing where they sent the alcoholics. With a lot of help from the back seat, he eventually found the building where his mother was housed and parked nearby. For a moment, they sat in the idle car and stared at the imposing structure. Stella asked, "Do we have any clue as to her diagnosis? Is it depression or schizophrenia or a nervous breakdown? Is she suicidal? Does she hear voices? Or did Pete just want her out of the house?" Flory was shaking her head. "I don't really know. She spiraled quickly, and Pete told me to stay away from the house. We've had these conversations." Trouble began just inside the front door, when a surly clerk demanded to know if they had made an appointment. "Yes," Flory explained. She had called 2 days earlier and spoken with a Mrs. Fortenberry, an administrator in Building 41, where they were now standing. The clerk said Mrs. Fortenberry had the day off because it was, after all, Christmas Day. Flory replied that she knew exactly what day it was, and the two young people with her were the children of Liza Banning, and they wanted to see their mother on Christmas. The clerk disappeared for a long time. When she returned, she brought with her a gentleman who introduced himself as Dr. Hilzebeck. At his reluctant invitation, they followed him down the hall to a small office with only 2 chairs for visitors. Joel stood by the door. In spite of his white lab coat, Hilzebeck didn't look like a doctor, not that they'd had much experience with psychiatrists. He had a slick head, squeaky voice, and shifty eyes, and he did not inspire confidence. Once situated, he arranged a file in the center of his desk and began with,
"I'm afraid there is a problem."
He spoke with an obnoxious northern accent, clearly condescending, and the name Hilzebeck was certainly not from anywhere in the South.
"What kind of problem?" Flory demanded.
She had already determined that she didn't like Building 41 and the people who ran it. Hilzebeck lifted his eyebrows, but not his eyes, as he preferred to avoid direct contact.
"I cannot discuss this patient with you. Her guardian, Mr. Pete Banning, has instructed me and the other doctors to engage in no consultations with anyone but him."
"She's my mother," Joel said angrily, "and I want to know how she's doing." Hilzebeck did not react to the anger, but simply lifted a sheet of paper as if it were the gospel.
"This is the court order from Ford County, signed by the judge up there."
He looked at the order when he spoke, again preferring to avoid eye contact.
"The commitment order. And it names Pete Banning as the guardian, Liza Banning as his ward, and it quite clearly states that in all matters regarding her treatment, we, her doctors, are to have discussions with no one but him. All visits from family and friends must first be approved by Pete Banning. Indeed, Mr. Banning phoned yesterday afternoon. I spoke with him for a few minutes, and he reminded me that he had approved no visits with his ward. I'm sorry, but there's nothing I can do."
The three looked at each other in disbelief. They had met with Pete for an hour the day before in the Banning home. Joel and Stella had asked about their mother, got no response from their father, and had not mentioned this visit. Joel glared at Flory and asked, "Did you tell him we were coming?"
"I did not. Did you?"
"No. We had talked about it and decided to keep it quiet." Hilzebeck closed the file and said,
"I'm really sorry. It's out of my control."
Stella buried her face in her hands and began weeping. Flory patted her knee and snarled at Hilsebeck.
They haven't seen their mother in 7 months. They are worried sick about her. I am very sorry.
Joel asked, can you at least tell us how she's doing? Are you decent enough for that? Hilsebeck stood with his file and replied,
I will not be insulted. Mrs. Banning is doing better. That's all I can say right now. Now, if you'll excuse me.
He stepped around his desk, stepped over Joel's feet, and squeezed through the door. Stella wiped her cheeks with the back of her hand and took a deep breath. Flory watched her and held her hand. Under his breath, Joel hissed,
That son of a bitch!
Which one? Flory asked.
Your brother.
He knew we were coming down here.
Why would he do this? Stella asked.
When no one replied, they let the question hang in the air for a long time.
Why?
Because he was hiding something? Maybe Liza was not mentally unbalanced and got herself shipped off because her husband was angry with her? That was not unheard of. Flory had a childhood friend who was put away while suffering through a bad case of menopause. Or perhaps Liza was really sick. She had suffered a severe breakdown with the news that Pete was missing and presumed dead, and perhaps she had never fully recovered. But why would he shield her from her own children? Or was Pete the crazy one? Perhaps he was scarred from the war and finally cracked up when he killed Dexter Bell. And it was futile to try and understand his actions. A slight knock on the door startled them. They stepped out of the office and were met by two unarmed security guards in uniform. One smiled and sort of waved down the hall. They were followed out of the building, and the guards watched them drive away. As they passed the lake, Joel noticed a small park with benches and a gazebo. He turned and drove in that direction. Without a word, he stopped the car, got out, and closed the door, lit a cigarette, and walked to a picnic table under a leafless oak. He gazed at the still waters and at the row of buildings on the other side. Stella was soon at his side, asking for a cigarette. They leaned on the table, smoking, saying nothing. Flory arrived a moment later, and the three braved the cold and thought about their next move. Joel said, We should go back to Clanton, go to the jail, have a showdown with him, and demand that he allow us to see Mom.
And you think that'll work? Flory replied.
Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know.
Don't be ridiculous, Stella said. He's always one step ahead of us. Somehow he knew we were coming, and here we are, staring at a lake instead of visiting with Mom. I'm not going back to Clanton right now.
Neither am I, said Flory.
We have reservations in the French Quarter, and that's where I'm going. It's my car.
But you have no license, Joel said.
That's never stopped me before. I've actually driven to New Orleans on one occasion, down and back without a hitch.
Stella said,
Come on, we deserve some fun.
5 hours later, Joel turned off Canal Street and onto Royal. The French Quarter was alive with the season, and its narrow sidewalks were packed with locals and tourists hustling to dinner and clubs. Buildings and street lamps were adorned with festive lighting. At the corner of Iberville, Joel stopped in front of the majestic Hotel Monteleone, the grandest hotel in the quarter. A bellhop took their bags as a valet disappeared with Flory's car. They strolled into the elegant lobby and entered another world. 3 years earlier, during the depths of the war, when the family was certain Pete was dead, but still praying for a miracle, Flory had convinced Liza to allow her to take the kids on a New Year's trip. In fact, Liza had been invited, but she declined. saying she was simply not in the mood to celebrate. Flory had expected her to say no and was relieved when she did. So they boarded the train without her, rode 6 hours from Clanton to New Orleans, and spent 3 memorable days roaming the Quarter, a place Flory adored and knew well. Their base was the Hotel Monteleon. In its popular bar one night, when she was drinking gin and Joel was sipping bourbon and Stella was eating chocolates, Flory had told them of her great dream of living in the French Quarter, far away from Ford County, in another world where writers and poets and playwrights worked and lived and threw dinner parties. She longed for her dream to come true, but the next morning, she apologized for drinking too much and talking so foolishly. On this Christmas night, the manager was summoned when she arrived with her niece and nephew. There were warm greetings all around, then a glass of champagne. A 9 o'clock dinner reservation was confirmed, and they hustled to their rooms to freshen up. Over cocktails, Flory laid down the ground rules for their stay, which amounted to nothing more than the promise not to discuss either of their parents for the next 4 days. Joel and Stella readily agreed. Flory had checked with the concierge to find out what was happening in the city, and there was much to explore. A new jazz club on Dauphin, a Broadway production at the Moon Dance, and several promising new restaurants. In addition to wandering the Quarter and admiring French antiques on Royal and watching the street acts in Jackson Square and having chicory coffee and beignets at any one of a dozen cozy sidewalk cafes and loafing along the levee with the river traffic and shopping at Maison Blanche, there was, as always, something new in town. Of course, there would be a long dinner at the townhouse on Charter Street, where Miss Twyla would be waiting. She was a dear old friend from Flory's Memphis years. She was also a poet who wrote a lot and published little, like Flory. Twyla, though, had the benefit of marrying well. When her husband died young, she became a rich widow, one who preferred the company of women over men. She left Memphis about the same time Flory built the Pink Cottage and went home. For dinner, they were seated at a choice table in the elegant dining room and surrounded by a well-dressed crowd in the holiday spirit. Waiters in white jackets brought platters of raw oysters and poured ice-cold Sancerre. As the wine relaxed them, they poked fun at the other diners and laughed a lot. Flory informed them she had extended their reservations for an entire week. If they were up to it, they could ring in the new year at a rowdy dance in the hotel's grand ballroom. Ford County was far away. Chapter 13. At 5 a.m. on Monday, January 6th, 1947, Ernie Dowdle left his shotgun house in Lowtown and began walking toward the railroad tracks owned by Illinois Central. The temperature was around 30 degrees, seasonal, according to the almanac Ernie kept in his kitchen. The weather, especially in the dead of winter, was an important part of his job. The wind picked up from the northwest, and by the time he arrived at the courthouse 20 minutes later, his fingers and feet were cold. As he often did, he stopped and admired the old stately building, the largest structure in the county, and allowed himself a bit of pride. It was his job to make it warm, something he had been doing for the past 15 years, and he, Ernie Dowdle, was very good at it. This would be no ordinary day. The biggest trial he could remember was about to begin, and that courtroom up there on the second floor would soon be filled. He unlocked the service door on the north side of the building, closed and locked it behind him, turned on a light, and took the stairs to the basement. In the boiler room, he went through his wintertime ritual of checking the four burners, only one of which he had left on through the weekend. It kept the temperature throughout the building at roughly 40 degrees, enough to protect the pipes. Next, he checked the dials on the two 400-gallon tanks of heating oil. He had topped them off the previous Friday in anticipation of the trial. He removed a plate and looked inside the exhaust flue. When he was satisfied that the system was in order, he turned on the other three burners and waited for the temperature to rise in the steam boiler situated above them. As he waited, he assembled a table from three soft drink cases and took a seat with an eye on the dials and gauges and began to eat a cold biscuit his wife had baked the night before. His table was often used for breakfast and lunch. And when things were slow, he and Penrod, the janitor, would pull out a checkerboard and play a game or two. He poured black coffee from an old thermos, and as he sipped it, he thought about Mr. Pete Banning. He had never met the man, but a cousin lived on the Banning farm and worked the fields. In years past, decades even, Ernie's people had been farm workers, and most were buried out near the Banning land. Ernie considered himself lucky to have escaped the life of a field hand. He had made it all the way to town and to a much better job that had nothing to do with picking cotton. Ernie, like most black folks in Ford County, was fascinated by the murder of Dexter Bell. After it happened, it had been widely believed that a man as prominent as Pete Banning would never be put on trial. If he had shot a black man, for any reason whatsoever, he probably would not have been arrested. If a black man murdered another black man, justice would be arbitrarily sought, and by white men only. Issues such as motive, standing, drunkenness, and criminal past were important. But the overriding factor was usually whom the defendant worked for. The right boss could get you a few months in the county jail. No boss could get you strapped to the electric chair. Now that it was apparent that Mr. Banning would indeed face a jury of his peers, no one, at least in Lowtown, believed he would be convicted and punished. He had money. And money could buy slick lawyers. Money could bribe the jurors. Money could influence the judge. White people knew how to use money to get whatever they wanted. What made the case so compelling to Ernie was the fact that no colored folks were involved. No blame could be placed on any of them. There were no black scapegoats. A serious crime with a white victim always led to the roundup of the usual black suspects, but not in this case. It was just a good old-fashioned brawl among the white folks, and Ernie planned to watch as much of the trial as possible. Like everyone else, he wanted to know why Banning did it. He was certain it involved a woman. He finished his biscuit and studied the gauges. The steam was boiling now and ready to go. When the temperature rose to 175 degrees, he slowly pulled levers and released the steam. It ran through a maze of pipes that led to radiators in every room of the courthouse. He adjusted settings on the burners while keeping an eye on the dials. Satisfied, he climbed the service stairs to the second floor and stepped through the door beside the jury box. The courtroom was dark and cold. He turned on one light. The rest would wait until exactly 7 a.m. He walked through the bar and along the benches and to a wall where a black cast iron radiator was rattling and coming to life. The steam from below was pumping through it and emanating the first wave of warm air that broke the chill. Ernie smiled, quietly proud that the system he maintained so well was working. It was 6:30 now, and given the size of the courtroom, with its 30-foot ceilings and balcony and old leaky windows that were still frosty, Ernie figured it would take over an hour for his 6 radiators to raise the temperature to around 70 degrees. The front doors of the courthouse opened at 8, but Ernie suspected the regulars, the clerks and employees, and probably even some of the lawyers, would begin drifting in through the side doors before then, all eager to watch the opening of the trial. Judge Rafe Oswalt arrived at 7:45 and found Penrod sweeping the floor of his chambers behind the courtroom. They exchanged pleasantries, but Penrod knew the judge was in no mood for small talk. A moment later, Ernie Dowdle stopped by to say hello and ask His Honor about the temperature. It was perfect, as always. John Wilbanks and his brother Russell arrived for the defense. They claimed their table, the one away from the jury box, and began covering it with thick law books and files and other lawyerly effects. They wore fine dark suits and silk ties and looked the part of wealthy, successful lawyers, which was the look everyone in town expected of them. Miles Truitt arrived for the state, along with his assistant district attorney, Malin Post, a rookie fresh from Ole Miss Law School. Truitt and John Wilbanks shook hands and began a friendly chat as they watched the crowd file in. Nix Gridley arrived with his 2 men, Roy Lester and Red Arnett, all 3 in clean, pressed, and matching uniforms, and with a thick layer of shiny black polish on their boots. For the occasion, Nix had deputized 2 volunteers and given them guns and uniforms and strict instructions to keep order in the courtroom. Nix moved around the courtroom, chatting with the clerks, laughing with the lawyers, and nodding at those he recognized in the jury pool. The spectators were shown to the left or south side of the courtroom, and the pews there were filling fast not long after the doors opened. Among the curious were some reporters, and they were given front row seats. To the right, the bailiff, Walter Willey, herded those who had been summoned. 70 registered voters had been selected by Judge Oswalt and the circuit court clerk, and they had been mailed letters 2 weeks before. 14 had been disqualified for various reasons. Those left in the pool looked nervously around the courtroom, uncertain as to whether they should feel honored to be chosen or terrified of serving in such a notorious case. Though their letters gave no indication of who was on trial, the entire county knew it was Pete Banning. Of the 56, only 1 had ever served on a trial jury before. Full-blown trials were rare in rural Mississippi. Everyone in the pool was white. Only 3 were women. Above them, the balcony was filling with Negroes, and Negroes only. Signs in the hallways of the courthouse kept matters segregated: restrooms, water fountains, entrances to offices, and the courtroom. Penrod, a man with status, was sweeping the balcony floor and explaining to others how the court system worked. This was his turf. He'd watched trials before and was quite informed. Ernie moved up and down the staircase, stopping by the balcony to flirt with some ladies. Hop from the Methodist Church was the man of the hour in the balcony because he would be called to testify. He was the state's most important witness, and he made sure his people knew it. They wished him well. At exactly 9:00, Walter Willey, who had been the volunteer bailiff for longer than anyone could remember, marched to his position in front of the bench, stood at attention, or at least his version of it, and commenced to howl.
"All rise for the court!"
His high-pitched squeal startled those who had never heard it before, and everyone scrambled to their feet as Judge Oswalt emerged from the door behind his bench. Walter Willey tilted his head back and, with his eyes on the ceiling, continued yodeling,
"Hear ye, hear ye! The Circuit Court of the 22nd Judicial District of the great state of Mississippi is hereby called to order. The Honorable Rafe Oswalt presiding. Let all who have business before this court come forward. God bless America and God bless Mississippi."
Such language was not required and could not be found in any code section, rule of procedure, court order, or local ordinance. When he had somehow assumed the job years earlier, and no one could recall exactly how he had become the court's permanent bailiff, Walter Willey had spent a lot of time perfecting his call to order, and now it was an accepted part of the opening of court. Judge Oswalt really didn't care. However, the lawyers despised it. Regardless of the importance of the hearing or the trial, Walter was there to give his ear-splitting call to rise. Another part of his act was his homemade uniform. The matching shirt and pants were olive khaki, nothing remotely similar to what the real deputies were wearing. And his mother had sewn his name above the pocket in bold yellow letters. She had also added some random patches with no significance on his sleeves. He wore a bright gold badge he had found at a flea market in Memphis and a thick black ammo belt with a row of shiny cartridges that gave the impression that Walter might just shoot first and ask questions later. He could not, however, because he had no weapon. Nix Gridley flatly refused to deputize him and wanted no part of Walter Willey and his routine. Judge Oswalt tolerated it with a wink because it was harmless and added a bit of color to the otherwise drab courtroom and dull proceedings. He settled himself at his bench and said,
"Please be seated,"
and arranged his flowing black robe around himself. He looked at the crowd. Both the gallery and the balcony were full. In his 17 years on the bench, he had never seen so many in this courtroom. He cleared his throat and said,
"Well, good morning and welcome. There's only one case on the docket this week. Mr. Sheriff, would you bring in the defendant?"
Nix was waiting at a side door. He nodded, opened the door, and seconds later appeared with Pete Banning, who walked in slowly with no handcuffs, tall and erect, his face showing no concern, but with his eyes on the floor. He seemed not to notice the crowd watching his every move. Pete hated neckties and wore a dark jacket over a white shirt. John Wilbanks had thought it important to wear a suit to show proper respect for the proceedings. Pete had asked how many men on the jury would be wearing suits, and when his lawyer said probably none, the issue was settled. The truth was, Pete didn't care what he wore, what the jurors wore, what anyone wore. Without as much as a glance at the audience, he took his seat at the defense table, crossed his arms, and looked at Judge Oswalt. Flory was three rows back at the end of a pew. Beside her was Mildred Highlander, her best friend in town, and the only one who'd volunteered to sit through the trial with her. She and Pete had argued over her attendance. He was dead set against it. She was determined to watch. She wanted to know what was happening for her own benefit, but also to report to Joel and Stella. Too, she figured that Pete would have almost no one else there pulling for him. And she was correct. Everywhere she turned, she got harsh looks from angry Methodists. Judge Oswalt said,
"In the matter of the state of Mississippi versus Pete Banning, what says the state?"
Miles Truitt rose with a purpose and replied,
"Your Honor, the state of Mississippi is ready for trial. And what says the defense?
John Wilbanks stood and said, "As is the defense." When both sat down, Judge Oswalt looked at the prospective jurors and said,
"Now, we summon 70 of you folks here as prospective jurors. One has passed away, 3 have not been found, and 10 have been sent home disqualified. So we now have a panel of 56. I have been informed by the bailiff that all 56 are present, are above the age of 18, under the age of 65, and have no health problems that would prevent jury duty. You have been arranged in numerical order and will be addressed as such."
It would serve no purpose to explain that the 10 who had been disqualified were basically illiterate and had been unable to complete a rudimentary questionnaire. Judge Oswalt shuffled some papers, found the indictment, and read it aloud. The facts as alleged constituted first-degree murder under Mississippi law, punishable by either life in prison or death in the electric chair. He introduced the 4 lawyers and asked them to stand. He introduced the defendant, but when asked to stand, Pete refused. He didn't budge and seemed not to hear. Judge Oswalt was irritated, but decided to ignore the slight. It was not a wise thing to do, and John Wilbanks planned to give his client an earful during the first recess. What could Pete possibly hope to gain by being disrespectful? Moving right along, the judge launched into a windy narrative in which he described both the alleged murder victim and the alleged murderer. At the time of his death, Dexter Bell had been the minister of the Clanton Methodist Church for 5 years, and as such, was active in the community. He was well known, as was the defendant. Pete Banning was born in Ford County to a prominent family, and so on. When the buildup was finally finished, Judge Oswalt asked the prospective jurors if anyone was related by blood or marriage to either Dexter Bell or Pete Banning. No one moved. Next, he asked if anyone considered himself a personal friend of Pete Banning's. 2 men stood. Both said they were longtime friends, and they could not pass judgment on Pete, regardless of what the evidence proved. Both were excused and left the courtroom. Next, he asked how many were friends with a member of the immediate Banning family, and he named Liza, Flory, Joel, and Stella. 6 people stood. 1 young man said he had finished high school with Joel. 1 said his sister and Stella were friends, and he knew her well. Another knew Flory from years back. Judge Oswalt quizzed them individually and at length, and asked if they could remain fair and impartial. All 6 assured him they could, and they remained in the pool. 3 said they were friends with the Bells, but claimed they could remain impartial. John Wilbanks doubted this, and planned to challenge them later in the day. With the war so recent and its memories still so vivid, Judge Oswalt knew he had no choice but to confront it head on. Giving almost no background, he described Pete Banning as a highly decorated Army officer who had been a prisoner of war. He asked how many veterans of war were in the pool. 7 men stood, and he called them by name and questioned them. To a man, each said he was able to set aside any bias or favoritism and follow the law and the orders of the court. 11 men from Ford County had been killed in the war, and Judge Oswalt and the circuit clerk had tried diligently to exclude those families from the pool. Moving to the other side of the matter, Judge Oswalt asked if any were members of Dexter Bell's church. 3 men and 1 woman stood, and they were excused outright, down to 50. And how many were members of other Methodist churches scattered around the county? 5 more stood. Three said they had met Dexter Bell. Two had not. Judge Oswalt kept them all on the panel. He had granted each side 5 peremptory challenges to be used later in the day. If John Wilbanks didn't like the looks or body language of a certain Methodist, he could dismiss him for no reason. If Miles Truitt suspected an acquaintance of the Banning family might be sandbagging, he could invoke a challenge and the person was gone. The 4 lawyers sat perched on the edges of their chairs and watched every twitch, smile, and frown from the jury pool. Judge Oswalt preferred to take control of the selection of his juries. Other judges gave the lawyers more leeway, but they usually talked too much and tried to curry favor. After an hour of skillful questioning, Oswalt had trimmed the panel to 45, and he yielded the floor to Miles Truitt, who stood and offered a big smile and tried to seem relaxed. He began by repeating and emphasizing something the judge had already covered. If the state proved every element of its charge of first-degree murder, the jury would then be asked to impose the death penalty. Can you really do that? Can you really sentence Pete Banning to the electric chair? If you follow the law, then you have no choice. It will not be easy, but sometimes following the law takes a lot of courage. Do you have that courage? Truitt paced along the bar and was quite effective at forcing each juror to consider the gravity of the task at hand. Some probably had doubts, but at that moment no one admitted to any. Truitt was concerned about the veterans and suspected they would be more sympathetic than they were willing to admit. He called on one, asked him to stand, thanked him for his service, and quizzed him for a few minutes. When he seemed to be satisfied, he moved on to the next veteran. The selection process crept along, and at 10:30, the judge needed a break and a cigarette. Half of the courtroom lit up, too, as folks stood and stretched and quietly exchanged opinions. Some left for the restrooms, others went back to work. Everyone tried to ignore the jurors, pursuant to instructions from the bench. At 11 a.m., John Wilbanks stood and looked at the prospective jurors. So much of what he wanted to say had been taken away from him by his own client. His plan had been to sow the seed of insanity early in the jury selection process, and then follow it with testimony that would be shocking, sad, credible, and convincing. But Pete would have none of it. Pete had done nothing to help save his own skin, and John could not decide if his client carried some type of perverse death wish or simply was so arrogant as to believe no jury would convict him. Either way, the defense was hopeless. John had already seen enough and knew which jurors he wanted. He would try to avoid all Methodists and aim for the veterans. But he was a lawyer, and no lawyer on stage with a captive audience can resist saying a few words. He smiled and seemed warm and thoroughly honored to be there doing what he was doing, defending a fine man who had defended our country. He lobbed a few questions at the panel as a whole, then he zeroed in on a couple of Methodists. But for the most part, his comments were designed not to uncover some hidden bias, but rather to convey warmth, trust, and likability. When he finished, Judge Oswalt recessed court until 2 p.m. and asked everyone to leave the courtroom. It took a few minutes for the crowd to file out, and while they waited, the judge informed the clerks and other curious insiders that it would be a good time to go find lunch. When the courtroom was practically empty, he said,
"Mr. Wilbanks, I believe you have a matter that you would like to present on the record."
John Wilbanks stood and said, "Yes, Your Honor,
but I prefer we do it in chambers.
We'll do it here. It's rather crowded back there. Besides, if we're on the record, it's really not a confidential matter, is it?
I suppose not. Judge Oswald nodded at the court reporter and said,
"We're now on the record. Please proceed, Mr. Wellbanks."
"Thank you, Your Honor. This is really not a motion or a petition to the court, because the defense is not asking for any type of relief. However, I am compelled to state the following for the record, so there will never be any doubt about my defense of my client. I had planned to pursue two strategies aimed at securing a fair trial for my client. First, I planned to ask the court for a change of venue. I was convinced then, as I certainly am now, that my client cannot receive a fair trial in this county. I've lived here my entire life, as has my father and his father, and I know this county. As we have already seen this morning, the facts of this case are well known to the friends and neighbors of Pete Banning and Dexter Bell. It will be impossible to find 12 people who are open-minded and impartial. After watching and studying the pool this morning, I'm convinced that many are not exactly forthcoming with their true feelings. It is simply unfair to hold this trial in this courtroom. However, when I discussed a change of venue with my client, he strongly opposed such a move, and he still does. I would like for him to be on the record."
Judge Oswald looked at Pete and asked,
"Mr. Banning, is this true? Are you opposed to a motion to change venue?"
Pete stood and said, "Yes, it's true. I want my trial right here."
"So you have chosen to ignore the advice of your lawyer, correct?"
"I'm not ignoring my lawyer. I'm just not agreeing with him."
"Very well. You may sit. Continue, Mr. Wellbanks."
John rolled his eyes in frustration and cleared his throat.
"Second, and even more important, at least in my opinion, is the issue of a proper defense. I had planned to notify the court that the defense would invoke a plea of insanity, but my client would have none of it. I had planned to present extensive testimony of the inhumane and frankly indescribable conditions that he suffered and survived during the war. I had located two psychiatric experts and was prepared to use them to evaluate my client and testify at this trial. However, once again, my client refused to cooperate and instructed me not to pursue such a course."
Judge Oswald asked Pete,
"Is this true, Mr. Banning?"
Without standing, Pete said, "I'm not crazy, Judge, and for me to try and act crazy would be dishonest."
The judge nodded. The court reporter scribbled away. The words were being recorded for history. For the defense, the words were damning enough, but it was his last utterance that would not be forgotten. Almost as an afterthought, Pete, who weighed every word in every situation, said, "I knew what I was doing." John Wellbanks looked at the judge and shrugged, as if in surrender.
Chapter 14. Juror number one was a mystery. James Lindsay, age 53, married. Occupation, none. Address, a rural road out from the remote settlement of Box Hill, almost to Tyler County. His questionnaire said he was a Baptist. He had volunteered nothing during the morning session, and no one seemed to know anything about him. Neither John Wellbanks nor Miles Truitt wanted to waste a challenge, so James Lindsay became the first juror selected for the trial. Judge Oswald called the name of juror number two, a Mr. Delbert Mooney, one of the sprawling Mooney clan from the town of Caraway, the only other incorporated municipality in Ford County. Delbert was 27 years old, had spent 2 years in the Army fighting in Europe, and had been injured twice. John Wilbanks wanted him desperately. Miles Truitt did not, and he exercised his first peremptory challenge. They were still in the courtroom, but they were alone, just Judge Oswalt and the lawyers. The defendant had been taken back to jail for lunch and until further orders. The bailiff, court reporter, clerks, and deputies had been banished. The final selection of the trial jurors was a confidential matter involving only the judge and the lawyers, and it was not on the record. They nibbled on sandwiches and sipped iced tea, but they were too preoccupied to enjoy lunch. The judge called the name of juror number 3, one of 2 women left. Some rules were written, others simply assumed. For serious crimes, the juries always comprised 12 white men. There was no discussion as to why or how this came to be. It was simply understood. John Wilbanks said, "We should remove her for cause, don't you think, Miles?" Miles was quick to agree. A for-cause challenge meant the prospect was obviously unsuited for jury duty, and rather than embarrass him or her in open court with a public dismissal, the ploy of a for-cause strike was reserved for private discussions. And most important, it did not count as a peremptory challenge. The judge simply ruled that the person would not serve, and this discretion was never debated. There was no urgency in their work. With very few prosecution witnesses, and perhaps none for the defense, the trial, once underway, would not last long. So they worked their way through the remaining names, accepting some, culling others, arguing professionally at times, but always making steady progress. At 3 p.m., Judge Oswalt needed another smoke, and he decided to send word to the crowd waiting in the hallways and sitting on the stairs and loitering outdoors in the cold that the trial would begin at 9 sharp the following morning. Those in the jury pool would remain nearby. At 4:30, the doors were opened. A few spectators drifted in with the jurors, and a few Negroes returned to the balcony. After the defendant was brought in and placed at the defense table, Judge Oswalt said that a jury had been selected. He called 12 names, and they made their way to the jury box and took their seats. 12 white men, 4 Baptists, 2 Methodists, 2 Pentecostals, 1 Presbyterian, 1 Church of Christ, and 2 who claimed no church membership and were likely headed straight to hell. They raised their right hands and swore to uphold their duties. Then they were sent home with strict instructions to avoid talking about the case. Judge Oswalt adjourned court and disappeared. When the courtroom was empty, John Wilbanks asked Sheriff Gridley if he could have a few minutes alone with his client. It was far easier to chat at the defense table than at the jail, and Nix agreed. As Penrod swept the floor around the spectators' benches and as Ernie Dowdle fiddled with his radiators, the defense team huddled with their client. Russell said, "I don't like your demeanor in court, Pete." John quickly added, "You seem arrogant and aloof, and the jury will pick up on this. Plus, you were disrespectful to Judge Oswalt. This cannot happen again." Russell said, "When the trial starts tomorrow, those jurors will spend half their time looking at you." "Why?" Pete asked. "Because they're curious. Because their job is to judge you. They've never done this before, and they're in awe of these surroundings. They will absorb everything, and it's important that you look somewhat sympathetic."
"Not sure I can do that," Pete said.
"Well, try, okay?" John said. "Take some notes and flip through some papers. Look like you're interested in your own case."
"Who picked that jury?" Pete asked.
us, the lawyers and the judge.
I'm not so sure about it. Looks to me like they've already made up their minds. I didn't see too many friendly faces.
Well, show them one, okay, Pete?
John looked away in frustration.
Remember, those folks get to decide how you spend the rest of your life.
That's already been decided.
Ernie's radiators were humming along at 9:30 Tuesday morning when Miles Truitt rose to address the jury in his opening statement. The courtroom was warm and once again packed, and Ernie and Penrod crouched in a corner of the packed balcony and watched with great anticipation. Everyone grew still and quiet. Truitt wore a dark brown wool suit with a vest. A gold chain dropped from a vest pocket. It was a new suit, one bought for this moment, the biggest trial of his career. He stood before the jury and offered a warm smile, then thanked them for their service to the state of Mississippi, his client. They had been carefully chosen to hear the evidence, to evaluate the witnesses, to weigh the law, and finally, to decide guilt or innocence. It was a heavy responsibility, and he thanked them again. First-degree murder was the most serious crime on the books in Mississippi. Truitt read its definition straight from the code. The intentional, deliberate, and premeditated killing of another human being without the authority of law by any means or in any manner. He read it a second time, slowly and loudly, each word echoing around the courtroom. And the punishment? Upon conviction of first-degree murder, the jury shall decide to impose death by the electric chair or life without parole. Truitt turned, pointed at the defendant, and said, Gentlemen of the jury, the Reverend Dexter Bell was murdered in the first degree by Pete Banning, who now deserves to die. It was a pronouncement that was certainly expected, but dramatic nonetheless. Truitt talked about Dexter, his childhood in Georgia, his call to the ministry, his marriage to Jackie, his early churches, his children, his powerful sermons, his compassion for all, his leadership in the community, his popularity in Clanton. There were no blemishes on Dexter, no missteps along the way. A fine young minister dedicated to his calling and his faith, gunned down at church by an army sharpshooter. Such a waste. A loving father taken away in an instant and leaving three beautiful children behind. The state of Mississippi would prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, and when the witnesses were finished, he, Miles Truitt, would return to this very spot and ask for justice. Justice for Dexter Bell and his family. Justice for the town of Clanton. Justice for humanity. John Wilbanks watched the performance with admiration. True, Miles Truitt had the facts on his side, and that was always a major advantage. But Truitt was subtle in his approach, understating some facts instead of taking a sledgehammer to them. The murder was so monstrous on its face that it didn't need affected drama. As Wilbanks watched the faces of the jurors, he confirmed what he had known for a long time. There would be no sympathy for his client. And with no proof of their own, the defense was dead, as was the defendant. The courtroom was silent as Miles Truitt sat down. Judge Oswalt looked at John Wilbanks, nodded, and said, And for the defense? Wilbanks stood and fiddled with the knot of his fine silk tie as he approached the jury box. He had nothing to say, and he wasn't about to blast away with some preposterous claim of mistaken identity or conjure up a bogus alibi. So he smiled and said, "Gentlemen of the jury, the rules of procedure in trials like this allow the defense to waive its opening statement until later when the prosecution